So, lecture 23, November 7th. Lecture notes, page 203. A little early, but you get the principle. Happy Veterans Day to all you veterans, or those of you who know veterans, or whatever, coming up. By the way, I don't have it on my calendar, but take Friday off for Veterans Day. So, research extra credit, number one, people are asking me when it's going to be posted. Just like it says there, it'll be posted when the researchers get back to me and verify you did it with attention. So probably next Wednesday is when it'll be posted. Here we are on the calendar. We are midterm two is up and running. You know that. It closes Saturday. You know that. Veterans Day, Friday, you get off. You should know that. Thanksgiving break coming up. Yay us. So midterm two closing Saturday at 6 p.m. Up and running, closing Sunday, is mini test 11 on that ongoing calendar. Enhanced learning extra credit number 8 closes tonight. 9 will open tomorrow. Reminds me, you have to get that set up. Don't let me forget that. And all the stuff on midterm number 2. How many people have taken it? How many people haven't taken it? How many people don't know what I'm talking about? Okay. Midterm number 2 is open, running 17% of your grade. Closes Saturday at 6 p.m. So, this was sort of an interesting story in the world of technology and marketing and retailing, etc. Walmart and Peacock have teamed up on an AI-powered set of shoppable ads. Fans of, does anybody watch Below Deck Mediterranean? Is that a show you watch? A couple folks, all right. So on Peacock, we'll soon be able to shop from the episodes in real time thanks to artificial intelligence, so technology and marketing. What's that mean? AI will comb through 3 upcoming episodes of Below Deck Mediterranean for Walmart products similar to the dishes or cookware used by the yacht's crew or apparel worn by the guests. Then AI will cause those products to be featured in an interactive carousel during the advertising breaks, which viewers can then scroll through using their remotes. The ad will then show users a QR code that takes them to a mobile checkout page for the selected items. So we're obviously getting consumers' attention. We're getting their involvement. There is the QR code from this particular episode. And here are a series of things that Walmart offers up that are similar to what's in the show you're watching from AI. The ads will also incorporate Walmart store inventory data to only display in-store products to viewers. The shoppable episodes of Below Deck Mediterranean air November and December, so technology and marketing at work. For so long, viewers had to take the hard route scouring the internet to find a product like what they saw their favorite icons or creators using in the show. Now, through the power of Must Shop TV, and with Walmart as our launch partner, Bravo fans can get even closer to the content they love by discovering the brands that are already part of this story. So again, getting consumer involvement. When I set these things up, even before each class, I often share them with my administrative assistant, my secretary. And I was describing this to her, and she was just shaking her head at it, saying, people are too lazy to look up their own products on the internet. They need AI to do it. I said, this is the wave of the future. What do you think? William White, Chief Marketing Officer for Walmart, says, we're always looking for innovative ways to shorten the distance between inspiration and the ability to purchase. By expanding our shoppable TV footprint with NBC Universal, we're pairing our incredible product assortment with some of the most talked about content so our customers can quickly purchase items inspired by their favorite cast members while they're watching the show. This is a great idea. I like it. I would really like to be able to buy a product from the show as it's happening because I'm inspired. This is a silly idea. If I want the thing, I'll look it up myself and buy it. You guys will have to stay tuned to see if you're right or the wrong about the future. Is this going to be the wave of the future that people really love? Hard to predict the future. Or then you go, meh, this is stupid. We'll find out, heavily invested in this new idea. Over to the area of promotion, advertising. 60% of major brands plan to increase their ad budget in 2024, upcoming year. New research shows big brands expect to increase their marketing budgets in 2024. 60% of company representatives say they will increase their global media budgets in 2024, with 14% saying they'll make significant increases year over year, according to a report from the World Federation of Advertisers and another firm, Equity. The increase comes despite 74% agreeing or strongly agreeing that in 2024, their media budget decisions are influenced by the economic climate. So we have crest factors, economics being one, outside the firm influencing them, yet doesn't really seem to be consistent with the view of the economic world. With 60% of respondents planning to increase advertising budgets, we see a level of confidence that seems contradictory to the prevailing economic outlook. With advertising typically seen as a two-quarter leading indicator of the wider economy, does this signify a recovery coming in mid-2024? Asks Nick Waters. So is this a way to forecast the economy? Are they ahead of the curve? Are we going to get a nice turnaround? Not normally what we think about, but there it is. This is a relatively dramatic increase compared to the same time last year when only 29% of respondents said they expected to increase their annual budget. The study is based on 92 company respondents, each spending $700 million on average. The total combined ad spend of all respondents represents approximately $500 billion. So there's a bit about the research sample. The report says that, unsurprisingly, digital will be the main recipient of the likely spend increase. Print is forecast to experience the greatest decrease in budget. So we see a bit about projected media choices in 2024 for businesses. And over again to costs and pricing, which has been our theme most recently. Those new online returns fees are driving away shoppers. How many of you guys send stuff back that you bought on the internet? Is that a common thing? I know my wife does that all the time. My joke is I think she has a thing going with the UPS guy. He's always coming and going and coming and going. And how many recognize that some places now charging you to return those products? Yeah. So how's this play out? New fees for online consumers to send back goods appear to be cutting back on returns, as retailers had hoped. But they could also be costing companies customers heading into the big holiday season. So we're thinking about a cost, fees in pricing, and also the relationship between costs and demand, one of the things we have to be able to forecast. About a third of companies surveyed by logistics company Happy Returns say they've lost customers since they began charging consumers fees to return items that they purchased online. That suggests merchants are seeing a backlash, even as more than half of them say the tactic has slowed the flood of goods they've seen coming back into their warehouses over the past 3 years. So you have this interesting challenge. You want people to buy products. You know they have to buy maybe more than they want because they don't know about the fit or the size or whatever. They're going to return some. How much money do you lose on those return products when you're paying the shipping? And then what do you do with the product? Sometimes you can't resell it. You just lose it. What's the trade-off there? What's the arithmetic for the retailer? Tom Enright, an analyst at research firm Gartner, said retailers risk alienating customers with the charges as the busy holiday season approaches, when returns often peak alongside increasing sales. Retailers last year expected nearly 18% of merchandise sold during the holiday season to be returned, according to the NRF. So understanding consumer behavior is important here. By bringing in a returns fee, you're at very best going to lose customers, says, as a retailer, says Enright. You're certainly not gonna gain anyone because you won't attract people to buy from you by making it more expensive for them to make the buy. So again, cost and demand. During the pandemic, consumers got used to ordering items such as apparel in several sizes and colors at all at one time to try on at home and then sending back whatever they didn't like. That sounds like something my wife was doing. So there's the impact of the pandemic on the consumers. Shoppers returned about 16.5% of the items they purchased online last year, up from 9.6% in 2019. Some companies also tried to press shoppers to bring items back to stores where they might buy something else, and the retailers can process those returns in bulk. The fees are often relatively low and don't actually cover the full cost of processing returns. Amazon charges a $1 fee when shoppers choose to ship returns through UPS rather than dropping off the items at certain stores, but that doesn't really cover the full cost. They're just trying to reduce the cost of these returns. So, an interesting world in which we're living, where retailers have to trade off this idea of the cost of returns against lost customers who don't want to pay the extra fee. Supply and demand, or not supply and demand, cost and demand. All right, lecture notes, page 203, chapter 14 in the textbook, page 383. We were in the middle of, and it was a not convenient place to break, in the middle of talking about pricing adjustments, pricing philosophies. We ended up with slide down the demand curve, and we did not get up to the next one, which was another demand-oriented pricing approach, prestige pricing. So this involves setting a high price. Why? To attract either quality-conscious or status-conscious consumers. And the idea is it should appeal to high-end consumers, and it should simultaneously limit the product to, quote, others. And if you can get it, you can afford it, and others can't, that, of course, enhances its appeal if you're status-driven to begin with. Buy a Rolex watch. You don't have one. Neither do I. It's an interesting concept, and I move away from the main lecture to comment. So in addition to teaching y'all, I also run a marketing module for small business development professionals. So they have to actually to be a small business development, advisor in the state of Ohio, you actually have to take this course with some other modules in it. And one of my little questions deals with a new client who wants to open a luxury chocolatier shop with special flavorings and pairings of special chocolates with wine and special events. And the question goes on to ask these real people, these real advisors, what sort of pricing would you suggest? And they often end up suggesting to me that what they should do is go for either slide down the demand curve or penetration pricing, which is low pricing in the marketplace to, quote, gain market share. Can you see how that's not consistent with a luxury product that's going to be expensive to hand make and pair with wines? How's that? If that's your model for your client, then your model has to change your business model, because it's not going to be a luxury prestige shop. So I don't know if it's hard for real world people to get the idea, but this would be consistent with a luxury shop, a luxury brand, right? And if that doesn't work in your market, then you've got to change your business model, is what I tell them. Anyhow, so that's what that's about. So here's the visual, right? So here we have the line going straight across. We set our price high, and we keep it high. Presumably over time, just like everything else, our price per unit drops down with greater and greater production. But we're not lowering our price, because it's prestige. So, Dom Perignon, Emporio Armani, Rolex, BMW, Bugatti, Prada, Louis Vuitton. We don't see these guys dropping prices to appeal to the masses. So, that's a different model. And the notion is, as it were, expensive is good. What are some advantages here? Well, because of the high price, we're not really going to sell in huge volume. Yeah. On the other hand, it's not a big problem because for each unit we do sell, we got significant profit going on. So we make up for that smaller volume with larger markup on each item that we sell. We know we're not going to sell masses. That's not our goal. Another approach deals with you having more than one product to sell. It's called price lining. It involves setting the price of a line of products at a number of different specific pricing points. Our example from Marketing News the other day was Baby Dior, which I still can't get over, $295 for a 3.5-ounce bottle of baby stuff. But anyhow, you saw that they had a couple items at $95, another item over here at $125, and another item over here at $295. And they want to price those products differentially so you can see there's a difference and then choose what's best for you. If they cluster them all together, then people just go for the cheapest. It's all the same. I'll take the cheapest. They're real close. So that's the idea of price lining. Even if customers don't know much about a particular set of products, they may perceive there to be a difference based on these price points. There must be a good, better, best here. That's why they're priced differently, I guess. I don't know. Now, if this works, if the differences in the models out there, you know, good, better, best, aren't readily apparent, not easily viewed, then price lining helps the customer to recognize that differences do exist, as long as your prices are noticeably different from one another. Again, if they're not, they cluster too close, people say they almost be the same, I'll take the cheap one. That's not what you're hoping for. This is an actual set of pricing recently for Optima projectors. At the top, we have the Optima HD 146X Bright 1080p home theater for $599. Then we move to the Optima, whatever that number is, it doesn't matter, for $779. Then the next Optima for $849. Then the Optima GT 2000 at $1299. And then finally, the Optima GT 5600 Ultra Short Throw, $1399. Now just look at those boxes. You can't tell how they're different from one another. I suppose you could read the specs and maybe sort of judge how they're different from one another. But how are you really going to know they're different from one another? Price point one, price point two, price point three. And you can see if those guys were all clustered really close to one another, $599, $610, $620, $650, clustered. You look at them, you can't tell any real difference. I'll get the cheap one, they're all the same. So we're trying to make that point with our consumers. These guys are different. And it's not easy to see it necessarily, so we're going to help you see with our price. Oh, holy mackerel, a new slide. So they get all the way up to $5,999. So they have quite a product line, quite a pricing scheme going on. In the B world, we saw a bit of price lining a while ago with our Intel computer chips. So for PCs, think of Celeron as being good, Pentium as being better, Core being best. Under the Core brand, the i3 represents the entry level of the Core family, the Core i5 and Core i7 representing the mid-level and high-level products. Celeron will stick around for entry-level computing, Pentium for basic computing, and Atom for devices such as notebooks and smartphones. Matt, have you been following? Oh, Matt's off doing other things. Never mind. He's my tech guy. Anybody know, have they gotten beyond Core i5-7? Are they up to i9 yet? Oh, thanks, Matt. They're up to i9, so I have to update my slide. But the principle is the same. Good, better, best in computer chips. Here's the impact of a crest factor on pricing. Intel had to raise the price of its CPUs in 2022. Intel informed its customers that it planned to raise the prices on many of its CPUs and peripheral chip products. And in some cases, the price increases may reach more than 20%. That's a fairly big price jump. The decision to increase prices stemmed from the more expensive shipping, labor, and parts costs, as well as inflation, and noted that the amount of the price increase would vary by product, the good, better, best product. So external factors certainly influence our pricing. What are some advantages of the price lining? Well, this is an interesting little twist. If, as a manufacturer, it doesn't cost you that much more money to go from good to better to best, but you can boost the price it between good, better, and best, then what do you find? Consumers may buy up to that higher priced, more feature-rich model that didn't cost you that much more to make. So, you know, they may not go for the top one, but I don't want the cheapest one. I'll go for the better one. And suddenly you're able to make some good profit on that because it didn't cost that much more to make it good, better, best. Disadvantage is that you may tend to focus a bit too much on price and what those price points have to be. So you may begin to overlook other issues of quality or consumer buying trends. You may just focus too much on the price points. If it's used as a regular practice, it may limit your ability of your business to meet competitors' prices, who know full well you're tied into this product line business, and they may start pricing things to mess with your good, better, best. And what are you going to do? Odd even pricing is another demand-oriented pricing approach that we see. It involves setting a price a few dollars or cents under an even number. And on the one hand, well, so we use prices in the that end in 5, 7, most often 9 for psychological reasons. So consumers tend to round down a price of $39.95 to, it's only $39, rather than rounding it up to what's actually closest, which is $40. I disagree with my own statement here. So my own statement is, it's not considered to be as effective today as it was in the past because consumers have become smarter about pricing. So the statement would be, well, consumers really know that $39.95 is close to $40. But you know what? We still see it used a boatload of places. Every one of those, I think everyone, every one of those for real prices ends in a 9. Why do they do that? They must believe that consumers sort of see it as the lower price point. Oh, it's roughly $39. Oh, here it is with cars. $39, $365, $44, $265, $44, $65. So we do see this idea of odd pricing going on quite a bit. Here it is in microwaves, $99.99, $119.99, $59.99. Consumers do still round it down. They aren't that much smarter, and marketers still use it. Target pricing, another demand-oriented approach. This is maybe the more rational way of pricing your product. You start by going out to the market and figuring out how much would a consumer pay for this particular thing, whatever the thing is. Then we work backwards, knowing the markup that the retailer has to take, the markup that the wholesaler has to take, and what our profit margin has to be. Based on those things worked backward through the supply chain, we then figure out what to put in the unit to get to that price point. So we can adjust our composition, our features of the product up or down to get to that target price point out on the other end. An interesting approach. I'm not sure it's used that often because it's too logical. So target price minus the markups in the chain minus the profit that we have to make would be our target costs, and that's what we would adapt in our manufacturing side of our house. Bundle pricing involves setting prices for two or more products as a single price. So for a buyer, they get a deal. The overall purchase of those two items together shows a savings compared to the purchasing of each product individually. And for marketers, this technique avoids making a price adjustment on each product if they feel like, well, if I adjust the price on product A down and product B down, people may think this is a cheap product or I'm having problems selling it. So we bundle them together. Also then, if you buy product B with product A at the point of purchase, I then capture the sale of both products, even though the price has been reduced a little bit, rather than risking you going off and buying product B somewhere else. How's that work in the real world? Well, how about this sort of thing. If you buy the Microsoft Xbox Series X 1 terabyte console, you get Assassin's Creed Valhalla for only $534.98. So we bundle them together. I'm going to sell you the unit. Why don't I sell you with it, bundled in to the price, the game as well? Yield management pricing, yet another approach. In this situation, what I'm going to do is charge a different price for the same good or service in different situations, in different markets. What I'm going to try to do with yield management pricing is to maximize my revenue, the amount of money I make, for a set amount of capacity at any given point in time. For example, you know full well, I think, that not everybody pays the same price for an airline seat. We're all getting on the plane together. We're all flying in the air together. We're all landing together, I hope. But that person over there pays a different amount for a variety of reasons. So I'm not talking about between business class and economy class. In economy class. How's that possible? Well, airlines switch their pricing depending on when you buy. Train seats, hotel rooms, they don't always sell for the same amount. The room's the same, the hotel's the same, the city's the same. Day of the week, how far in advance you order it. Rental cars, concert seats, sell at different prices as time goes on. This requires that there be a fixed amount of resources. Theater seats, there's only so many seats. Train seats, only so many seats. Hotel rooms, only so many hotel rooms. And that the resources being sold are perishable. You can't save them up. So there's a time limit to selling the resource. If that hotel room is empty on Friday, you can't go back and sell it again on Saturday, for Friday, it's gone, it's empty, there's no revenue. If that concert ticket doesn't sell for the concert, it doesn't do you any good to have it empty, you know, tomorrow. What are you gonna do with it? It's empty, there's no concert. So after that point, those rooms, seats, cease to be of value. It also requires that different customers are willing to pay different prices for using the same resource. That people are willing to sit next to each other on an airplane and know they paid different prices and do it. So there are a couple approaches that you can use here, depending on your industry. One approach is what airlines often, not always, often charge more for people who book later. Vacation planners, casual travelers often book in advance. Business travelers are often last minute. They got to do it right now for tomorrow. A business meeting came up. So the people who book later are often business travelers. They're less sensitive to price. They're willing to pay more. They got to get there soon. The fashion industry often prices the other way around. They charge less. They discount later in the season as the item is moving out of fashion as the season changes. You know, it's the end of summer. You don't want to be holding boxes and boxes of swimsuits. People aren't really buying that much in the fall and the winter. Let's get rid of them. Let's price lower as the season moves on. So just depends on your situation as to whether or not this makes sense and whether or not you'll bring in revenue that you would have otherwise lost. Lower the price of the room on a Wednesday, hoping more people will come into the room. Let's switch our perspective. Let's switch away from focusing on demand-oriented pricing approaches to cost-oriented pricing approaches. One approach here is standard markup pricing. So in this case, what you do is you add a fixed percentage to the cost of all items in a specific product class. Usually, we're talking about adding a fixed percentage to a retail price. For example, for new luxury jewelry, the markup at retail can be 250 to 300%. Let's head scratch on that for just a minute. 200% profit above what I paid for the thing? I buy it for 100? Where are my accounts? I buy it for 100. What do I sell it for if it's a 200% markup? What am I selling it for? Buy it for 100, 200% markup? What would 100% markup be? What would 0% markup be? Nobody knows nothing. Webbies, are you out there? Can you help these people out at all? Somebody help me out. What's 100% of $100? $100. So if I have 100% markup, what would I sell my $100 product for? $200. If I have a 200% markup, what would I sell it for? Holy mackerel, $300. So now we got that far along in the story. I bought it for 100, I'm selling it for 300. Does that seem like a lot of profit? Yeah. Why does a product like a jewelry product have such a high markup? Well, what you're absolutely right. One way of thinking about it is it makes it more status or more luxury. Absolutely right. We talked about that. What's another reason that a product, you run a jewelry store. Congratulations. You're selling jewelry products. Why would you have to have a pretty good markup on each one you sold? Go. Because you don't turn them over that often. That jewelry sits on the shelf for a couple weeks or a couple months, right? So when you finally sell one, you got to make some money on it, is the logic. Exactly so. Thank you, and thank you. Services are often set at something like a 50% markup over the cost of the service. Your results may vary. Sometimes we use this standard markup pricing approach to refer to the manufacturer setting the wholesale price, so it's not always on the retail. But in general, retail price is equal to their cost plus the markup, is the logic. So let's look at how we might calculate markup percentages. So percent markup on selling price. So the markup on the selling price as a percent is equal to the markup dollars divided by the selling price times 100. And if we're doing it on cost, and it matters if you're giving your intern the charge, the order to write price tags, they got to know if they're setting it up on selling price, if they're setting it up on cost. So it does matter. So markup on cost percent is equal to the markup dollars divided by the cost times 100. So here we have this Gagan Friha watch. I want to get the industry markup of 125% of cost. We know that markup on cost percent is equal to markup dollars divided by the cost times 100. So on the next slide, we're going to get rid of this little percentage. We're going to multiply both sides times 100. So, or divide both sides by 100. So markup percent on cost is equal to markup dollars times 100 divided by cost in dollars. I'm dividing both sides by 100 to get rid of that percent. So with our numbers, 125% divided by 100 is equal to the markup dollars that we're trying to find, divided by our cost, which we just specified back here as, I'm just telling you, 36. And after division, you get 1.25 is equal to the markup dollars divided by 36. We're going to multiply both sides by $36. So 1.25 times 36 is equal to the markup dollars, which is equal to $45 of markup. Cost 36. Markup percent, 1.25. Markup dollars, $45. So what's our selling price? Our selling price is our cost of 36 plus $45. We're going to sell this for $81. And it gives me, as the retailer, the industry markup on cost of 125%. Basic arithmetic. I'm not sure why I'm showing you the watch again. Puts me in the typical price range for this product. I'm sure at some point, I see. So this watch typically does sell between, that's why it's back again, typically does sell between $61 and $102. So for our example, our sales price is $81. Let's look at it a different way. We're going to do markup on selling price. So the cost to me is $36 for each product I want to sell. And I'm selling the product for $80. So what is my markup on the selling price? So markup on selling price in percent is equal to markup dollars divided by selling price times 100. Same logic. Here's our selling price. Here's my cost. So the markup itself is $80, my selling price, minus $36, my cost, or $44. So the markup on selling price percent, $44 divided by $80 times 100, or 55%. So I now know that my markup on selling price is 55%. Obviously, if we were there, we had a reason to be there. A different cost-oriented pricing approach is cost plus pricing. So just as markup pricing arrives at price by adding a certain percentage to the product's cost, cost plus pricing also adds a particular fixed dollar amount, usually, to the cost. So you hire in a painter to paint your dorm room. Are you allowed to paint your dorm room? And your painter comes in and says, okay, I'll paint the dorm room for $150 plus the cost of I'll do it for the cost of the paint and the equipment plus $150. Same thing I was going to say. So they're going to charge you a particular amount plus the cost of doing the thing. So in this case, my fixed monetary amount is $150, and then whatever the other costs are, we're going to add it in. But we could add a fixed percent to the manufacturing cost. Looks a lot like what we just talked about a minute ago, but that's also considered cost plus pricing. Experience curve pricing, talking about something we've seen before, is a pricing approach we've already considered. We just haven't named it this before. It's based on the learning effect. It says the unit cost of many products and services declines by 10 to 30% each time our firm's experience at producing the thing and selling them doubles. We're going to have that much less unit cost. This results then in the possibility of rapid price reductions. And it does suggest, as we've talked about in another context, an advantage to market leaders. So that's the idea of that downward sloping cost curve that I showed you in the visuals before. This is just another name for it. It's experience curve pricing. Let's turn our attention to profit as the basis for our pricing. One approach under a profit-oriented pricing scheme is to go with target profit pricing. Here, we're going to set an annual profit target in dollars, or we might set a target return on sales pricing. Here, I'm going to set prices to achieve a profit that's a specific percent of the units sold, 15%, 18%, whatever it is. Or I might set a target return on investment pricing. Here I'm going to set my prices to achieve a specific annual return on investment. I know that people that invest in my company could put their money somewhere else. I have to show a reasonable return on investment or else investors won't invest. Here's what I'm shooting for. The problem with all of these is they don't take much account of demand. So sure, I'd like to have 400% return on investment. Let me price it to make that. Who's ordering the product if it costs that much money? So again, you can have your goals. What's realistic in the real world is another matter. But these would be things that you could think about. Competition-oriented pricing, another approach. One approach is, this is all too hard for me to think about and I don't care. So I'm going to simply set my prices based on whatever the traditional price in this channel of distribution is. Whatever people do, that's what I'll do. That could work out for you, I guess. Or you could go for above at or below the market pricing. So here I'm going to turn around and look at my competition, use them as a reference point, and I'm going to either price above them. There has to be some reason you're able to do that, but okay. The same as them, which is pretty much customary pricing, or below them. I'm going to try to buy their customers with a lower price point. The next one's a little tricky. It is a competition-oriented factor, and it's called loss leader pricing. In this case, I'm going to set the price below its usual price or below its profitable price. Let's head scratch on that for a minute. How long are you going to stay in business if you're purposefully pricing your product below the profitable price? I got to ask you what you're thinking there. Is that real? Do marketers ever price a product below the profitable price? If so, when? Competition is there and they're pricing it lower and you're going to price it below your profitable price? How long is that strategy going to work for you?
Until your competitors.
Oh, you're thinking about like maybe a price war. I'll price lower, they'll price lower, someone's got to give up. Interesting, maybe. We try to stay away from that, but it could happen. Did I see another hand there? You're scratching your head. What else might I price my product lower than the usual price or lower than the profitable price? Yeah. If a company what? Oh, yeah, if they're going out of business and I'm just trying to scrape out the last possible thing I can make. I'm not making any profit, but it's just better than just throwing it away. All right. Any other ideas? You. Ah, there's another. Well, you guys are coming up with some interesting ideas. So it's not impossible to imagine a company that's selling something like a console or maybe a huge, massive office printer at less than profitability, but they know that you're going to come back in the office printer for their services and maintenance and maybe the console, maybe you'll come back for their particular games. That's an interesting idea. The one I was thinking of, which I'll now share with you, is the idea of a loss leader in a retail grocery store. Coca-Cola is normally, I don't know what it is these days, $1.39 for a 2-ounce liter. I'm going to offer it now for 99 cents. I'm not making any money on that. Why might a grocery store do that? Are they hoping that people stock up on 99 cents 2-liter bottles? And there we go. We're hoping that people come in the door, right, for that. And while they're there, they see that they need some more Kumquat Flingrum Ding Dongs, etc. And then it's not a permanent strategy. It is to fight off competition and to draw those consumers in. The goal is not to make money on that item because it's below standard price or even at a loss leader, but to attract consumers' attention with the hopes they'll buy other more profitable products at well, kumquat flavored ding dongs, games, service maintenance. So it may not be a long-term strategy, but it is a way to get attention away from the competition, hopefully onto us. Oh, an actual question. It rarely happens, but sometimes I've seen it occur. A rare beast, a question. Yes? I don't know in particular what their strategy was in the summer, but I would say since in the summer wasn't the price of gas silly high for a while? Yeah, so I'm going to guess what they were doing is drawing people in. Those sorts of establishments make almost no money on the gas they sell anyhow. Where they make their money is literally people going in the store and buying those products inside the store. So their logic might have been against competition, how people are upset. Gas prices are crazy high. We're going to lose money, we know, loss leader, on the gas we're selling with the assumption that when people come in, they're buying kumquat-flavored ding-dongs, whatever it is they buy in the sheet store. So that would be my assumption of what their logic was. And they didn't keep it at 99 cents. They aren't crazy. So they did it for some time period to get people's attention, to draw them in. It either worked or it didn't work, and then they moved on. How many people go to Costco's? Yeah? Anybody ever get the good old Costco's rotisserie chicken? Those are pretty good, yeah? So Costco's rotisserie chickens are well known as a loss leader, which is defined as merchandise sold at a loss in order to draw customers, just what we're talking about. In other words, Costco is willing to sell those chickens at, I don't know if it's still, but $4.99, even if they're not making any money on them, because chances are good that you're not making a trek all the way to the Costco warehouse and just buying a single $4.99 chicken. Even if you think you're just going to run in and grab a hot rotisserie chicken and beeline it to the registers, how often does that really happen? You remember, you're almost out of laundry detergent. Or you see that pair of designer jeans that you totally don't need, but they're so cheap you just have to have them. Or you get suckered into buying a 36-pack of sausages because the sample was so good. 9 times out of 10, you're leaving Costco with a whole lot more than that $4.99 rotisserie chicken and a whole lot less money in your wallet. Costco might be willing to sell you a delicious chicken for under $5, but they're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They know that people that come in almost always are buying more stuff. They make up for it. All right, let's move on to step 5 of our ongoing pricing process and think about setting the list or the quoted price. One approach in doing this is to set one price for all buyers. It's called a fixed price policy, and an awful lot of products are sold that way. When you go into the grocery store and you buy a gallon of milk, you're pretty sure you're paying the same for that gallon of milk as the next person in line. They didn't get a cheaper deal on it than you did. Also called a one price policy. So a lot of products are like that, yeah? That might be your strategy. Or maybe you're going to work with a flexible price policy. This involves setting different prices for products and services depending on the individual buyers, the purchase situation that they buy it in or under, and that might be your strategy, also called dynamic pricing, which we're going to get into much more detail here in a little bit as a strategy. So what sorts of things are going to influence this? Well, one is the idea of the sort of company you're in, the sort of company you're running. If you have product line pricing, that's going to influence what your list or quoted price is. You can't get those guys too close to one another. You got to keep distance. Customer effects, what does our price convey to the customer in our target market? Again, I told you what a $295 bottle of baby lotion conveys to me. You're out of your mind, but I'm not in their target audience. So what's it convey to your target audience? Competitive effects. This is the example that you actually brought up. Price wars for us. Price wars occur when we need to cut our prices to increase or maintain our unit sales or our market share against competition. Then they cut their prices to win customers back from us, and this goes back and forth. It's not really a good thing for the businesses. You want to try to avoid that. Who wins in this situation in a price war? Who wins? The consumers win, but you don't want to fight. So you want to consider that as you're setting your price. What's the competition going to do? How upset will they be? You might think about special adjustments to your list or quoted price. One thing you might consider is offering a discount, a quantity discount. So here we're going to offer reductions in unit costs for larger orders. The assumption is that we get economies of scale savings, and we pass some on to our customers. Anybody work in a warehouse by any chance? Oh, a bunch of people. Can I query you on warehousing for a minute, for those of us who don't know? So what sort of warehouse do you work in? Sam's Club. And so you had to bring stuff into the stock room and stock it up, yeah? And then you had to keep track of it. I guess somebody had to do. And then you had to take stuff out to the front. Not so much? Yes, sort of. Who else was does yours work a similar way? Where were you stocking? Bitcoin mining. I'm going to set you aside because I don't know enough about Bitcoin mining to talk about it. So in this case, if you're in a warehouse, if you're doing that sort of work, imagine a big warehouse where you're putting out orders all the time. And so they've got, I don't know what you're selling, they got pencils over there and jelly over there and reams of paper over there. So you got to go out and fill an order. So you run it over there, and then you bring it back, and then you run over there, and then you run over there and bring it back. And you're doing one and one and one. Takes some time, takes some effort. By the way, you got to fill out the paperwork. You got to fill out that you took it off the shelf, et cetera, et cetera. Somebody still has to fill it, though, somewhere. Maybe you aren't doing it, but somebody else is filling it somewhere, back at the warehouse, other warehouse. So that's a pain in the butt. It's expensive. It takes time. Tell you what I'm going to do. Instead of ordering one and one and one, if you order 20, 20, 20, I'm going to give you a discount because I save money. I'm not running him around all day long getting ones and ones and ones. The economy is scale, less paperwork, less human time. I'll give you a little discount on the price is the logic. In a non-cumulative quantity discount, the price reduction is based on a single order. The larger order will reduce our billing costs, our order filling costs, our shipping costs, our sales costs. So on that one order, you order 20, I'll give you a discount. Or another approach is to use a cumulative quantity discount. Here, the deal, the price reduction, is based on the total quantity purchased over some time period. Could be a quarter, 6 months, in the B2B world, a year. The goal here is to encourage the customers to return to us for their reorders. You come back, and at the end of the year, based on your purchases, I'll give you blah, blah, discount. So it draws people back. Seasonal discounts are another way to think about adjusting your list price. These are reductions based on the time that the purchase is made. We're trying to reduce variations in our sales based on time of day, day of week, week of year, month of year, whatever. And so we're trying to find ways to even that out a little bit. For example, the travel industry offers much lower rates in the, quote, off season. When's the expensive high season in Florida? What time of year? Say again? No, it's way too hot in the summer for a lot of people. They flock down in the winter when it's cold in the north and warm. And that's not to say no one goes in the summer. But the high season is the winter because people flock down there. In the summer, for a lot of people, it's too hot in Florida. We lower our hotel prices to draw people in the summer, and then we raise them up in the winter to get people there. But it also can be based on the time, on the day of the week or the time of the day, if we're trying to even things out. For example, early bird specials for restaurants, right? Who works in a restaurant at dinner? What time's the dinner hour in a restaurant? Nobody works in a restaurant? Holy mackerel. So early bird is at 4 p.m. Let's give a discount to the seniors who are slow and they don't eat that much anyhow and they're not going to spend a lot of money. Bring people in at 4 and then have the regular for a discount and then have the regular price at 6. Movie theaters. When are movie theaters, to the extent they're busy at all, when are movie theaters busy? The weekend? Evening, right? When aren't they busy? Tuesday afternoon. What if we give you a deal to come in Tuesday afternoon? So here's the weekend early bird special at the Oak Harbor Cinemas. Saturday, October 11, and Sunday, October 12 at 10 a.m. Tickets are only $8.50 for the judge and $6.50 for the equalizer. Come on in early for that day. You'll get a deal. Come in early and find a combination you love for less. Early dinner duos, only $8.99, Monday through Thursday, wherever that is. Trade discounts are another way to go to adjust your list price, also called functional discounts. These are reductions in list price that we offer our channel of distribution members for helping us out, for doing something for us in the future. So we manufacture the thing, fine and good. It doesn't just sit in our plant where we manufacture it, does it? Because then it wouldn't make us any money. So what happens next? Well, probably have to ship it somewhere. That's going to cost some money. Maybe the people aren't ready for it right away, so I got to warehouse it somewhere. Then I got to ship it again to get it to wherever it's going. Then I got to keep it on the shelf. A lot of stuff going on here. Tell you what I'm going to do. If you do some of that stuff for me, I'll give you a discount because I don't really want to do it. Example, these functions include warehousing, stocking the shelves with your products. Trade discounts are often combined to include a series of functions out there for a channel member. For example, a 30, 20, 10 series of functional discounts could indicate a 30% discount to the retailer for carrying the product out there, a 20% discount to the wholesaler for holding, warehousing the product for us and shipping it, and a 10% discount to the jobber who's out there making sure that we have inventory on the shelf, keeping the shelves right. And so these represent adjustments to our list or quoted price. So, for example, the manufacturer sets a list price of $100 for a product out on the retail store shelf. The manufacturer offers a trade discount of 30% to the retailer for stocking the product. So the retailer's cost is $70. That's $100 minus 30% or $30 discount, also 30% discount, becomes sort of their profit. The wholesaler gets a trade discount of 20% off the price to the retailer. So they buy it for $56, which is $70 minus $14, the 20%. The jobber gets a trade discount of 10% for buying it and keeping it stocked for $50.40. So the manufacturer sells the product to the jobber for $50.40. It goes on the retail shelf at $100 if it's being sold at our manufacturer's suggested retail price. So these are functional discounts. We slough off some of the duties on other people. This is the same 30-20-10 example. $100 minus $30 is the $30 I just, 30%, the $20, yeah. Minus the 30% is the $30 I just talked about. Minus the 20%, which is $14, I'm just showing you the arithmetic. $56 to the wholesaler, 10% for the jobber, so $5.40 to the jobber, which is the manufacturer's selling price in the channel. All right, so functional discounts, another way to adjust that list or quoted price. Looks like I go on a little bit long about this. So this is like the text example on page 396-97. There they're doing 30-10-5, same logic as we just went through. Also, you might give a discount to someone that you're selling your product to for cash, if they'll pay cash. They don't make you wait 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, and they don't give you a credit card, they pay you cash. Why would I want to give somebody a discount for paying me cash, for not making me wait 30, 60, 90 days to get paid? Why does it matter to me? Well, let's say oftentimes what you might see is your invoice is due in 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. But it might also say discount if you pay now in cash. To avoid people deadbeating you? All right. Why else? But you give a discount for cash today. Well, there you go. So I'm running a business. I've got expenses. I got payroll to meet. I got inventory to product to buy inventory. You're going to wait to pay me for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days, which is not uncommon. What am I doing for money in the meantime? I'm taking out a small business loan. that small business loan is going to cost me some percentage that I have to pay back. Tell you what, you give me the money right now, I'll give you a discount. I won't have to pay them the interest and I'll still be ahead, is the logic. Allowances. So we give you a trade-in allowance. In the B2C world, anybody ever buy a car and get a trade-in allowance on their old car sort of thing? Maybe your parents did. So that's to draw you in and give you a little reward, adjust the final price. Or in the B2B world, a promotional allowance. If you will spend money promoting my product, dear wholesaler or dear retailer, I'll give you a price reduction so that you're helping me out here. Geographic adjustments. Shipping can be expensive. We talked about return shipping, but shipping the product out can be expensive, especially in the B2B world for big expensive things. So how are we going to figure this into our pricing scheme? Well, one approach is called FOB, origin, free onboard origin. So in this case, the shipping cost from the factory or the warehouse is paid by the buyer. So if my plant is in Kent, Ohio, and you're buying in Akron, you pay some amount of money, but it's less than if you're buying in Michigan or California, because the shipping costs go up and up. So the buyer pays the shipping. So the net effect of this is that the buyers pay different costs for the product because of shipping. In this case, ownership of the goods is transferred to the buyer as soon as it leaves my shop, as soon as it leaves the point of origin. Then either the buyer or the seller can arrange for the shipping. Why am I making a big deal about ownership? Why do we care who owns the product when? Why is that important? Why is it important to think about who owns the product when? So in this case, I'm saying as soon as it leaves my shop, it's yours, you own it. Why does that matter? Yeah. Insurance, damage, lost, theft, it goes out of fashion, it rots. Somebody's responsible for that. Is it you or is it me and when? And so it's important to know this little detail. So in this case, as soon as it leaves my shop, it's yours, congratulations. You're responsible for the insurance and you're responsible for any loss of anything. And then we'll agree that you or I can arrange for the transportation. So here we have the FOB origin. On the left-hand side, in the teeny little print, it says seller, title transfer, buyer's goods out to the buyer. Uniform delivery pricing is a different approach to think about how you're going to count shipping. In this case, the shipping cost from factory or warehouse is included in the selling price. Here, ownership of the goods is not transferred to the buyer until it's delivered. And the seller, because they own it, is responsible for the transportation. In a single zone pricing scheme, the same price is charged to all buyers regardless of their location. If I mail a envelope from Kent to Kent, I don't know, anyone know what a price of a stamp is these days? It's funny, we don't have any idea what the price of a stamp is. No? How much? $12 for a stamp? Not for a first class stamp, no. But let's say it's 62 cents. So, say again, please. Oh, I'm sorry, she's picking on me. Wait, I gotta see what she didn't like about my answer. I'm sorry, tell me. Share. Oh, well, I mean an individual stamp, though, within there, because you're only sending one letter with a stamp. So, I don't know, you have to do the arithmetic. But let's pretend it's 62 cents for a stamp. We'll agree to pretend. But it ain't 12 bucks for a stamp. So 62 cents. How much did it cost me to mail that envelope from Kent to Kent? 62 cents. How much does it cost me to mail it to Los Angeles? 62 cents. Thank you. So this is the idea of single zone pricing. Everybody is charged the same thing regardless of their location. Multiple zone pricing has a situation where prices increase as shipping distances increase, depending what you're selling. If you're selling a large machine, you probably aren't going to charge everybody the same price wherever they are in the country. It's going to cost different amounts to ship it. So here we're going to increase our costs, our price, as the shipping distances. Sometimes we do it by drawing concentric circles on a map. Our plant or our warehouse is in the middle. We have zone one, zone two, zone three. And if you're in a zone, that's where we set our price. Or if our thing's really big and bulky and hard to ship, maybe we set irregular boundaries that reflect geography, population density, transportation infrastructure, and of course the actual shipping costs themselves. So it may look a little strange. Here's an example of multiple zone pricing with three zones. Yeah, Cleveland plant is at the center of zone one. The base price for the product is $100. And if you live in zone one, I'm going to charge you $10 shipping. So it's $110 to you. But if you live in zone two, St. Louis, you're going to pay $100 for the price of the product itself and $20 shipping. So to you, it's $120. And if you're all the way out in zone three, then you're going to pay $130. So customers in each zone in our multiple zone pricing scheme pay different shipping costs. Complicating things, another scheme based on geography, is a basing point pricing approach. In this case, I have a variety of different warehouses, a variety of different manufacturing plants, and those cities where I have the plants or the warehouses are designated as basing points, and all goods shipped from a given basis point are charged the same amount, no matter how far or near they are from that base city. So it's a little different vision. In this case, St. Louis is our basing point, and we charge $120 to everybody, regardless of the actual freight cost. So Chicago pays $120 even though the freight cost is $10. Seattle pays $120 even though the freight cost is $30. Los Angeles pays $120 even though the freight cost is $20. Presumably you've done the arithmetic and you know how you can either make a profit or at least not lose money in the scheme. So you might do freight absorption pricing where the seller absorbs all or part of the cost of transportation on a special deal as a special promotional idea. So at the holidays, what do you often see on the products? Shipping included. The seller might reason that if they can get more business, then its average cost will decrease, and that will more than compensate for the extra freight cost. And we can use this pricing for market penetration. We're going to try to hold on to in increasingly competitive markets, we're going to offer free shipping. They're not doing it right now, so it's a competitive action as well. Dynamic pricing has become quite the thing given technology today. Until recently, most companies set a price and it stayed pretty consistent for a fair amount of time. How are we going to change it? Why are we going to change it? This is the price. With digital advances, there are more opportunities to adjust your price to reflect the value of the experience to the consumers in the moment. In the moment. Companies like Amazon can monitor prices 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and do. And they can correlate huge amounts of information. And they can make faster and more granular price adjustments than had ever been possible before. And this is the idea of personalized dynamic pricing. So if this is an approach that makes sense in your industry, the idea is you're going to take six actions. First of all, adopt a new pricing mindset. Move away from aligning price to the product alone. Recognize that price is a reflection and quantifiable measure of the customer experience. As the experience changes, so must the price that is attached to it. It's a little hard for me to actually understand sometimes during the day, Amazon will shift its price 10 times based on its assessment of the value of the product to the consumer. How can the value of a microwave oven change that much during the day? I can see if we're talking about chocolates near Easter, okay, but it's true, they do that. Walk in the customer's shoes, consider all the factors that influence the buying experience, as well as the potential effects that a change in the sales context might have on a customer's expectations. At the same time, identify the data sources that enable a deeper appreciation of buyers' lives, the environment in which they live, the issues that they face, their mood or mindsets at the point of sale. Armed with these insights, segment your customers more precisely, more empathetically, and create product and pricing offers that best meet their needs. Harmonize price and experience. Gain affinity and grow revenue by fairly correlating prices with the level of experience that's delivered in different channels. This may involve reconsidering your channel strategy, creating online brands to reach some consumers who want reliable supply or low price, and have a different pricing scheme for those who want the shopping experience to be in the retail environment. Then you have to make sure your offline and online experiences work to complement, not to contradict each other for your brand. Build the right team. You have to have the right skills to convert data into prices and experiences that customers want. Focus on executional excellence. Speed is critical in dynamic pricing. You have to make sure your feedback mechanisms are in place, and you have to be accurate. Be agile. So sales and marketing leaders have long known that price and experience can be bound together. Consumer packaged goods that adopt dynamic pricing will be able to compete in entirely new ways and use customer affinity to drive growth with pricings that are accurate and fairly reflects the value of their shopping experience. It's a little nutty, but it's a real world thing happening every day today. Here is a microwave oven being sold at the beginning of the day at $899.99 by Sears, $809.99 at Best Buy, and $744.46 at Amazon. As the day goes around, Amazon is watching what's going on. You can see Sears just held its price steady. They don't make any price changes. For reasons I don't know, at 5 a.m., Amazon bounces its price up, it bounces up again at 8, it bounces it down at 9, based on its algorithms, up at noon, etc. And Best Buy just made a couple changes based on its data, two price changes during the day. This is based on their algorithms and understanding of what consumers want when. I do have a little video on it, but I don't have time to show it. So have a good weekend, happy Veterans Day, have a good day off, see you next time.